Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We've seen very credible reports of deliberate attacks on civilians, which would constitute a war crime. We've seen very credible reports about the use of certain weapons. And what we're doing right now is documenting all of this, putting it all together, looking at it, and making sure that as people and the appropriate organizations and institutions investigate whether war crimes have been or are being committed, we can support whatever they're doing.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken on CNN yesterday. While it might seem remarkable that the U.S. Secretary of State went so far as to say there are credible reports of war crimes in Ukraine, Blinken is actually following on the heels of Karim Khan, prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, who said last week he has sent an investigative team to Ukraine to seek and gather evidence, if it exists, of war crimes by the Russian military. And that comes after days of urgent calls from Ukrainian officials who say Russia has used cluster bombs, thermobaric weapons, and targeted Ukrainian civilians.
В Ірпені було вбито родину: чоловіка, жінку і двох дітей.
A family was killed in Irpin, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said yesterday. The family was fleeing when missiles struck Irpin, roughly 16 miles northwest of Kyiv, according to witnesses. Quote, a man, a woman, and two children right on the road, as in a shooting club, Zelensky said. How many families like this have died in Ukraine? We will not forgive, we will not forget, we will punish everyone who committed atrocities in this war on our land. We will find everyone who shot at our cities, our people, our bombed land, launched rockets, who have made the order and pressed start. There will be no quiet place on this earth for you, except the grave. End quote. Well, Richard Weir joins us. He's a researcher in the Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch, and he's in Lviv, Ukraine. Richard, welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beattie is with us as well. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Richard.
Well, today we want to understand as much as we can about the allegations of war crimes being made by Ukrainian officials. We want to understand what ICC investigators are seeking, and also, more deeply, the rules and limitations of international law when it comes to protecting civilians when one nation invades another. So, Richard, I understand that you just left Kyiv a few days ago. Can you tell us a little bit of what you saw or what you know about what's happening around Kyiv before you left?
Sure. Yeah. No, I was actually in Kyiv on the day that that President Putin declared war anew on Ukraine and the invasion began. And shortly after, or in the morning hours, we started hearing explosions around the city of Kyiv. And then shortly thereafter, Russian troops entered Ukraine from multiple directions. Of course, Kyiv isn't the only city at risk of being encircled or being attacked. In the early hours, we saw attacks using weapons such as cluster munitions, which are internationally banned in cities in Donetsk and later in Kharkiv. And as all that was happening, of course, the Russian troops began bearing down on multiple cities, including Kyiv. And during the time that I was there, Russian forces began encircling the city, with nightly bombings taking place around the city and its environs as Ukrainian forces tried to prepare defenses.
Mm. Can I just step in here quickly, Richard, if I could? So about those cluster munitions, has Human Rights Watch been able to confirm that they have been used in Ukraine?
Yes, in fact, in two different locations. So in a city in Donetsk, really in the opening hours of the conflict, around 10:30 a.m., a ballistic missile carrying cluster munitions sort of detonated near a hospital. and released what are called submunitions, or basically small bombs that disperse fragments or little pieces of metal that are designed to destroy personnel, to kill them or injure them, seriously injure them. And these small bomblets or submunitions detonated all around the hospital, killing four people and injuring another 10, including medical workers, and causing damage to the hospital. We also, you know, days later, we also investigated three different attacks in the city of Kharkiv, which has now come under intense attack, shelling by Russian forces, where many civilians have been killed. So this is something, of course, that we've documented elsewhere, and it was very disturbing to see happen really in just the very first hours of this invasion.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, your thoughts here.
Well, the whole idea of war crimes and international universal sort of jurisdiction over them was introduced at the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War. And Justice Robert Jackson, in his opening statement, framed the challenge this way, the challenge of prosecuting these crimes. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. Well, they certainly haven't been repeated on the scale of Nazi death camps, but the world since has seen no let or hindrance, it seems, on wars against civilians and war crimes. And partly that's because, and Justice Jackson spoke to this, he said, unfortunately, the nature of these crimes is such that both prosecution and judgment must be by victor nations over vanquished foes. Mm. And that's the crux. You've got to catch the villains and to punish them in real time, you've got to defeat them and be on the winning side. And that, of course, it makes the thing seem more like vengeance than justice. But the prosecution of war crimes lags so tragically behind the fact that it almost seems like a kind of distraction. War crimes from the real crime, which is war.
Yeah. No, Jack, I mean, it's an excellent point. And we'll dive much more deeply into that crux that you talked about in a few minutes here. But Richard Weir, Jack's observation there makes me wonder, the ICC investigative team that has been deployed to Ukraine to seek evidence of, if it exists, of war crimes, what kind of evidence would they be trying to seek and preserve?
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, what constitutes a war crime, there are a number of different, I mean, especially so most of these crimes themselves have been enumerated in the Rome Statute, which is essentially the treaty that lays out the different crimes that are associated with sort of war crimes, also crimes against humanity. It also covers genocide, but it lays out a number of different crimes, including the so-called grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which have been crimes and are meant to be prosecuted and sort of incorporated into national statutes everywhere after the Geneva Conventions were put into place and came into force. But they're going to be looking for evidence of things like direct attacks that are directed at civilians. Attacks. These are attacks that effectively aren't targeted at any particular military objective, or things like a disproportionate attack. That is an attack that that is launched at something that might be a military objective, but where the harm done to civilians is expected to be excessive in relationship to the military advantage gained by that attack. There's also other things like widespread sort of destruction of civilian property. There's torture, and there's things like attacks on humanitarians or humanitarian aid, or these items that are indispensable to the survival of the civilian population. So there's really no shortage of crimes to investigate. And there's really a wide range of things that they'll be looking for.
And before we have to take our first break here, Richard, just a couple of more quick questions about facts on the ground as you and Human Rights Watch know them at this moment. The other things we've been hearing over the past several days from Ukrainian officials, for example, the assertion that the Russians have been using thermobaric weapons. What do you know about that?
Right. So Russia does have thermobaric weapons in its arsenal of various different kinds, those that are air-launched or ground-launched. That's not something that we've been able to or that we've seen yet in deployment. That, of course, doesn't mean that something like that hasn't happened. It's just not something that we've specifically documented. Of course, one of the difficulties is conflict is spread throughout the vast territory of Ukraine, and it is very difficult to get to some areas to do investigations, and so it makes it very difficult to corroborate some of these claims. But certainly the use of such a weapon, particularly in a populated area, would almost certainly constitute a violation of the laws of war.
Mm. Well, Jack Beattie, we've got about a minute here before our first break, and I'm still thinking about what you said a little while ago. And, you know, as Richard, of course, well knows and others know, if we're thinking back to the use of cluster munitions, first of all, there's the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which more than 100 countries have signed. I note that not Russia, Ukraine, or the United States have signed that convention in particular. And then also, if I understand correctly, you know, Russia has used cluster munitions in the very recent past, for example, Syria. And yet, to your point, Jack, what has happened in the wake of that? Nothing. So what does that make you think about what may be forthcoming regarding possible war crimes in Ukraine? We've got 30 seconds before the break, Jack.
Well, it makes one almost despair at the idea of punishment and even more of deterrence against repetition. On the other hand, you have to maintain the standard. You have to say it's wrong, even if the wrong goes unpunished.
Well, Jack Beattie and Richard Weir with Human Rights Watch in Lviv, hang on for just a second. There's so much more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the investigation into possible war crimes by the Russian military in Ukraine. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. He's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And also with us from Lviv in Ukraine is Richard Weir. He's a researcher in the Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch. And Richard and Jack, if you can just hang on here for a minute, I want to focus particularly on what the Russian military's capacity and tactical decisions tell us right now. And Jeffrey Edmonds joins us to do that. He's a research analyst at CNA and an expert on Russia and Eurasia. Previously was director for Russia on the National Security Council and acting senior director for Russia in 2017 during the 2017 presidential transition. Jeffrey Edmonds, welcome to you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us, you know, we're having this conversation within the context of trying to understand possible war crimes or human rights violations that could be going on in Ukraine. Tell us what you see in terms of the decisions that the Russian military has made that might help us understand what's going on the ground if there are war crimes happening.
Right. So the ground offensives have made very little progress over the last several days. And in general, since the beginning of this conflict, the Russian military has performed really, really poorly and have been unable to take many of their objectives that they've set out. I mean, clearly, the primary objective remains taking the capital of Kyiv. And I think what they believed was that they could just drive into Kyiv. And then once that city was taken, the rest of the resistance would fall apart. That's clearly not the case. And so, unfortunately, what I think we're going to start seeing is much more heavy-handed tactics. They're already doing this, but I think that's going to even become worse over the coming days and weeks as the Russian military becomes quite exhausted from its current objectives.
So you heard a little earlier when Richard Weir said that one of the definitions of a war crime is when a military attacks, for example, a city area, and the cost and consequence to civilians far outweighs the military gain. Is that not likely in the scenario you just outlined, Jeffrey?
I think it is. Unfortunately, I think that the Russian military will be rather indiscriminate in the same way that it was in Syria. I've often said that, you know, Aleppo is very peaceful now because, you know, most of the population in that city is dead. And the Russians are just known for taking very heavy-handed tactics. And I don't think Putin at all would shy away from massive civilian casualties.
So there's a sense, though, that there's no what's the withdrawal scenario, if at all, or at least pulling back from urban targets?
I don't think there is one, to be honest with you. I think that the Russians, I mean, they still clearly believe that if they can take Kyiv, the rest of the resistance in the Ukrainian military will fall apart. But in my mind, you know, what they end up having, let's say they do take Kyiv and they put in a puppet government, they can't leave the city because that puppet government wouldn't survive. And so you're stuck trying to occupy a country with a military that's exhausted and a resistance that's rather strong. And so I don't actually think he has a viable exit strategy.
Okay, well, and so then tell me more, Jeffrey, about what you think may come down the line in the next few days, because, you know, as we discussed, there's cluster munitions, thermobaric weapons. What about even the battles that have been going on around nuclear installations in Ukraine?
Yeah, those have been very disturbing. I mean, luckily, you know, it appears that those facilities are secure. I mean, even if they're in Russian hands, you know, the Russians understand obviously how to use these facilities. It's not good that they've fallen, but at least it doesn't appear that there's continued offensives around the nuclear facilities.
Okay. One last question for you, Jeffrey, because when we're talking about war crimes, of course, there are from the top to the bottom of the chain of command, there are the people who issue the orders and then the soldiers on the ground who carry them out. How much should we be reading into, you know, what's been emerging on social media about Russian POWs or members of the military there who are surrendering and saying they didn't know what they were being ordered to do, that morale is low in the Russian military? I mean, how do you read all that?
So I think those are rather serious and significant. So it's, I mean, in any kind of, you know, war, you're going to have, you know, Private Edmonds taking off because he doesn't want to fight. It's a whole nother thing when an entire crew of a vehicle departs. And then what we're seeing even beyond that is three or four vehicles lined up, completely fueled, perfectly running, and no crew members. Now, if I were a military commander, that would really worry me. And so I think as the Russian military becomes even more exhausted and are asked to do things like fire thermobaric bombs into cities, I think that might actually increase significantly.
Hmm. Well, Jeffrey Edmonds, research scientist at CNA and previously director for Russia on the National Security Council, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Richard and Jack, let me just hear briefly from both of you. And Richard, I'll just turn to you first here. You heard Jeffrey's analysis that he sees just nothing but escalation in the near future, and that may lead inevitably to war crimes or human rights violations. Richard, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, you know, that concerned us about the possibility of an invasion or an escalation here is the fact that we've documented for years the conduct of the Russian military And, you know, specifically, you know, he mentioned Aleppo, and you know, even more recently, I worked on a report that Human Rights Watch released that had to do with the Syria-Russia-led offensive in Idlib back that culminated in March of 2020 with a ceasefire. But during the course of that campaign, the alliance between Syria and Russia, they committed crimes against humanity. This is widespread or systematic attacks against civilians. And even in that particular scenario, we identified the possibility that the Russian military commanders, all the way up to President Putin, may bear responsibility for that campaign, which included the commission of serious violations of the laws of war. And you know, if you're looking at the situation now, you know, one of the things that we're paying close attention to is how different cities fall under the control of the Russians, or the way that they conduct themselves in these cities. And I have to say, you know, particularly in places like Kharkiv or in Mariupol, the indications of future conduct are bleak. The kinds of attacks that we've seen in Kharkiv, be it with the use of cluster munitions, which are indiscriminate weapons, or, you know, the repeated shelling of areas, destroying homes, destroying schools, trapping people with disabilities or older persons in their homes, making it difficult to get out, and as medicines, supplies dwindle. This is all deeply, deeply concerning and paints really, really, a horrible picture for what may come, particularly as with respect to the city of Kyiv.
Jack, your thoughts?
Well, it may all come down to, or at least a lot of it, to the decision of almost at the tactical level of officers on the scene. Mm-hmm. Do we fire at this hospital or not? Do I press this button or not? Do I drop this bomb? And such people are subject to one of the Nuremberg principles, Principle 4. The fact that a person acted pursuant to orders of his government of a superior does not relieve him of responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible to him. So the standard is that there is a higher law, presumably, than being ordered to do something. And it's going to come down to, I think, to commanders to see whether they're going to risk disobeying orders to save lives and disobeying orders in the certainty that they'll be punished for it. That's a heroic expectation of ordinary men, and yet it happens again and again in warfare that soldiers reject patently barbaric and inhumane orders.
Mm. Well, let's bring Philippe Sands into the conversation now. He joins us from London. He's a professor of law and director of the Centre on International Courts and Tribunals at University College London, also author of East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. Professor Sands, welcome to you.
Lovely to join you.
So I actually want to start with somewhat of a granular question for you, Professor, because I wonder, this is actually, in my mind, almost a first in one respect, and that is we're seeing the almost real-time documentation of what's happening in Ukraine through cell phone videos, social media, etc. Now, of course, sifting through what's factual and not is a particular challenge here. But does this vast amount of documentation, does it make any difference in terms of how war crimes investigations ought to take place?
Well, firstly, thank you. It is different. I mean, you mentioned my book, East West Street, which, of course, is largely set in the city of Lviv, and which tells the story of how two of the crimes you've been discussing over the past 30 minutes, crimes against humanity and genocide, actually find their origins in that city. The events really of 1914-18 and 1939-1945. My grandfather was born in Lviv, and he left in the summer of 1914 as a 10-year-old boy from the very same station, that's train station, that's been in the news throughout. Of course, in 1914, most people had no idea what was going on. I went through all the original cuttings from the New York Times from that period, and they were covering these terrible events from 1914, but of course 5, 6, 7 days later, and only piecemeal. Speaking personally, I mean, you know, I'm sort of glued to my computer screen, going around surfing, looking for stuff, the latest updates of what's going on, in part because I know Ukraine so well, and in part because the images that we're seeing are so graphically appalling. I've got no doubt that the war crimes are being committed. You saw the terrible events of yesterday of civilians apparently being directly targeted as they left Irpin. But it also appears to be being done on a scale that is systematic to the point that I think it can be called a crime against humanity. This is on a scale that is horrendous. And as you rightly point out, there is no lack of material. That doesn't mean it's not going to be complex for prosecutors to prove, because they have to link a particular act of horror, a particular crime, with a particular perpetrator. And that is not an easy thing to show.
Professor Sands, before we get more deeply into international law today, I would love if you could to tell us more, you know, about Lviv historically, as you mentioned. Just tell us more.
It's an amazing city. I went for the first time in October 2010. I was invited to give a lecture on the cases that I do at international courts on crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, the crime of aggression, all of which, of course, date back to 1945 and the famous Nuremberg Tribunal. I arrived, I accepted the invitation because I really wanted to find my grandfather's house. I thought of him as a Frenchman. He moved eventually to France, and so I knew him for nearly 40 years, and he never talked to me about his Lviv past. I discovered an astonishing city. It was when he was born, on the outer edges of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It changed hands four times in the space of a month in November 1918. Austria, Poland, Western Ukraine, Poland. You couldn't invent this place. But even more significantly, and you couldn't invent this, it was the home to two men, Hirsch Lauterpacht and Raphael Lemkin, who are the individuals who put the concepts of crimes against humanity and genocide into international law. So the points of connection with today's events are very real. And of course, I've been back every year for 12 years now, once or twice. I have many friends there. I'm on the phone daily with people there and in Kiev, and I'm utterly horrified with what is happening.
And the crimes that that occurred there in the First and Second World Wars?
Well, a short note on international crimes. You've basically got four international crimes. You've got the oldest is the 19th century war crimes, how you conduct warfare and armed conflict. And you've been having a very good discussion about that, some of which I was very pleased to catch. And then in 1945, when the idea arose to create a tribunal to prosecute Nazi leaders for the crimes they'd perpetrated, they realized they really didn't have enough crimes, so they had to basically invent three more, which they did and then applied retroactively, which has always been a bit problematic. One of those was crimes against humanity, the harming of individuals on a systematic scale. The second was genocide, the famous word invented by Raphael Lemkin, which is the crime of destroying a group. And the third, and I hope we have a chance to talk about it, was called in 1945 crimes against peace. That is to say, waging an illegal war. Today, it's called the crime of aggression. And at Nuremberg, that was the most grave and the most serious of crimes. And to be very frank, I mean, I'm strongly supportive of investigating and prosecuting crimes against humanity and war crimes. But at the end of the day, the one that really counts is the small number of individuals who decided to wage this horrendous and manifestly illegal war, and that is the crime of aggression.
We will talk about that extensively in the last third of the show, Professor Sands. I promise you that. But Richard Weir with Human Rights Watch, you're there in Lviv right now as we speak. I'm just wondering, the thoughts are going through your mind as you heard what Professor Sands had to say.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, it's quite surreal here. You know, I didn't spend the first days of the war here. And coming from Kyiv, of course, the city now seems much more peaceful. But you know, it is a city, of course, now thronging with displaced persons, many using this as a way station to head out, to many through Poland to make their way to the rest of Europe. So it's quite unfortunate to see such a city with such beauty turned into, a place of temporary refuge. Maybe it's a few months, maybe it's just a few hours as people come in and out of the train station. Many of them taking the train directly from Kyiv, escaping, really the imminent encirclement of the city, or even from further away.
Mm. Jack, we've got about 40 seconds before our next break. We'd love to hear you for a moment, though.
Well, just to pick up on what Professor Sand said, the Nuremberg judgment on aggressive war reads, to initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. Quite a statement. The accumulated evil of the whole is subsumed under the decision to launch an aggressive war as Russia has done.
Well, we are talking this hour about war crimes and investigating war crimes in Ukraine right now. Jack Beattie joins us. Richard Weir with Human Rights Watch is with us as well. And Professor Philippe Sands at the University College London joins us as well. And when we come back, we'll hear for a couple of minutes from the last surviving prosecutor from Nuremberg. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about investigating possible war crimes in Ukraine. I'm joined by Philippe Sands. He's director of the Center on International Courts and Tribunals at University College London. Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, is with us as well. And Richard Weir is with the Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch, and he's with us from Lviv in Ukraine. And gentlemen, just listen along with me, because we really wanted to get a much deeper understanding of how history redounds in this moment today. So back in 1947, a young prosecutor represented the United States in what was, of course, the most important war crimes trials of the 20th century, the Einsatzgruppe and portion of the Nuremberg trials, the largest mass murder trial in history.
We are now ready to hear the presentation by the prosecution.
This was the tragic fulfillment of a program of intolerance and arrogance.
My name is Benjamin Ferenc. When I was 27 years old, which was a long time ago, I was the chief prosecutor for the United States at one of the subsequent Nuremberg trials.
The case we present is a plea of humanity to law,
which tried and convicted 22 high-ranking Nazis of murdering in cold blood over a million people, mostly Jews and mostly in the Ukraine.
We shall establish, beyond the realm of doubt, facts which, before the dark decade of the Third Reich, would have seemed incredible.
Benjamin Ferenc is now 101 years old. He turns 102 on Friday, and he is the last living prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials.
I found, the records of the special extermination squads known as Einsatzgruppen in German. Their assignment was to kill all the Jews in Europe.
Reports will show that the slaughter committed by these defendants was dictated not by military necessity, but by that supreme perversion of thought, the Nazi theory of the master race.
They sent a daily report back to the headquarters in Berlin, listing which units, A, B, C, or D, of the Einsatzgruppen were located where in the Ukraine, for example, and how many people they had killed. When I totaled 1 million people murdered on a little adding machine, I went to Nuremberg from Berlin, where my headquarters was then located, and said, we have to put on a new trial. He said, we can't. The lawyers have already all been assigned. The Pentagon is not enthusiastic about this. We can't get approval. I said, you can't let these people go. I have in my hand here 1 million people murdered. You're not going to let those bastards get off. And he said, well, can you do it in addition to your other work? And I said, sure. He said, okay, you do it. I ended up there as my first case. And you said, it takes a long time. It took me a long time. 2 days. 2 days. And I arrested the prosecutor's case. And I convicted all of them.
We shall show that these deeds of men in uniform were the methodical execution of long-range plans to destroy ethnic, national, political, and religious groups which stood condemned in the Nazi mind. Genocide, the extermination of whole categories of human beings, was a foremost instrument of the Nazi doctrine.
That was what we were trying to do. We were trying to bring justice in place of vengeance, because vengeance just begets more vengeance. And I made a specific point, I said, the opening statement, vengeance is not our goal.
Vengeance is not our goal, nor do we seek merely a just retribution. We ask this court to affirm by international penal action man's right to live in peace and dignity, regardless of his race or creed.
Nuremberg set the standard for justice in the wake of unspeakable war crimes. Since then, much, but not all of the world has joined, for example, the International Criminal Court in The Hague. But even there, as Ferenz acknowledges, successful prosecutions are exceedingly difficult and exceedingly rare, in part because of resistance from the very nations who fought to defeat the Nazis.
But we can't be defeated by the fact that there are some people who don't believe in the rule of law. They believe in power, and they want to exercise it whenever they think it's in their interest to do so, and they're a very sizable number of people. So it's not something where everybody is of one mind. There are some people who believe in the rule of force. That's what gets us into the current situation. The only hope really is law, not war. The three words, law, not war.
Benjamin Ferenz. In 1947, he was just 27 years old and the chief prosecutor for the United States in the Nuremberg trials. He's 101 years old now. Jack Beatty, your reaction?
Well, it is sobering for an American to read Mr. Ferenz's comment on the Iraq War. He says, a prima facie case can be made that the United States is guilty of the supreme crime against humanity, that being an illegal war of aggression against a sovereign nation, Iraq. According to the Iraq body count documents, we're something like 200,000 violent civilian deaths have happened in Iraq up to February 2020, beginning with the U.S. invasion. He called that a supreme crime against humanity. And the question of who's to blame and who can be punished, well, the U.S. has absented itself from the International Criminal Court on the grounds to protect its leaders. The ostensible reason was we don't want our soldiers being prosecuted. The real reason, as subsequent reporting has brought out, was captured by a comment that a senior official made to the Times. The soldiers are like the capillaries, the top public officials, President Bush, Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Powell. They are at the heart of our concern. Henry Kissinger, that's what they really care about. Mm. In other words, we didn't go into this court because we wanted our leaders to be protected against prosecution for crimes against humanity, that crime being aggressive war. And one wonders, when this decision was made in the fall of 2002, whether our leaders were looking forward to the invasion of Iraq and thinking, well, perhaps we'll, you know, we need to protect ourselves against any international prosecution.
So, Professor Sands, this brings us squarely into what you wanted to talk about before, the crimes against peace. Now, I would say many people are familiar with the other crimes that you outlined, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. But even the phrase, the crimes against peace, is less familiar. Now, educate me here. Has there been any prosecution for crimes against peace since 1947?
I'm sure you don't need to be educated, Meghna. They have not at the international level. What was called in 1945 crimes against peace has transformed over the years through to 1998 as the crime of aggression. It's now in the statute of the International Criminal Court. The final definition was only agreed 3 or 4 years ago, and it came into force in 2019 for 43 countries, but not yet in respect of Ukraine. And since Russia has not accepted the statute of the International Criminal Court, it cannot be invoked at the ICC in The Hague. And that's what leaves the gap. How powerful it was to listen to dear Ben Ferencz now. I've known him for many years, not quite for 102 years, but he is a remarkable human being. He has signed on this week to the statement issued by Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, for the creation of a crime, a creation of a tribunal to investigate whether Mr. Putin and his closest cohort are responsible for the crime of aggression. And I literally, as we speak, I'm reading on my screen that the leader of the opposition in Britain, Sir Keir Starmer, the former director of public prosecutions, has announced he supports that. The group known as the Elders have just in the past 4 hours come out for this. That's former leaders of many countries of the world. And the UK Foreign Secretary has just given evidence in Parliament to say she's now actively considering the creation of a special tribunal. Mm. So this is an issue which is going up the agenda. The US so far has been very silent. I believe that President Zelensky, in his next conversation with President Biden, is going to raise this issue. I sure as hell hope that the Americans will not stand in the way of this, because it is the only way the law can be used to focus on the most serious perpetrators, Mr. Putin and the group that is immediately around him that took the decision to wage this war.
Okay, but let me ask you, though, because what you heard what Jack was saying, it's understandable to have a little bit of, or a lot of, cynicism about even the possibility of some kind of prosecution in this moment, because world leaders have acted with such impunity even just over the past 20 years. Russia in Syria, the United States in Iraq. So what would make at all this moment any different?
Indeed. I think the reason and just to be clear, I mean, I found myself in strong opposition to the war in Iraq in 2003 on legal grounds. But of course, I'm now working with a number of individuals who are actively engaged in supporting it. But that is as it is. I think what's significant about this moment, and here I'm speaking from a European perspective, there have been many appalling conflicts over the last 20 plus years. I've been involved as a lawyer in many of them. I'm thinking of the Congo. I'm thinking of Rwanda. I'm thinking of Cambodia. Appalling situations. And frankly, as terrible as what is happening now in Europe. I don't believe in a sort of Premier League of horror. The difference with this one, from a European perspective, is that it is the first time in 75 years or more now that such things have been seen on European territory. We had the former Yugoslavia from 1991, and that was appalling, but it was reasonably contained within certain barriers. And I think what it is here, it's the fear that this is going to spread and that all possible steps have to be taken to stop it. And that is what's concentrated the mind, I think, so powerfully.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought up the former Yugoslavia, because I was just thinking, yes, Milosevic was put on trial, but even that was exceedingly difficult. I mean, Richard Weir, let me thank you for your patience here and listening along, but let me turn back to you here. Your thoughts on what you're hearing regarding at least bringing into focus as well the concept of crimes against peace or crimes of aggression in the Ukrainian context.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, one thing I just want to say in general is that, you know, we've been talking a little bit about impunity and the impunity that the various leaders have enjoyed for crimes and various commanders have enjoyed, whilst committing these crimes. And I think this is a key point. You know, what we do at Human Rights Watch and what others do, of course, is to document these violations to ensure that in some way, by some jurisdiction, that victims' rights will be vindicated, and that there won't be impunity for these crimes. And it's not, of course, the case that everybody receives the justice that they're due or the redress that they're due legally or morally. But it is the case that oftentimes, or is the case sometimes at least, that their rights are vindicated by courts of various stripes, whether that's the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda, or in some cases still the International Criminal Court, or national jurisdictions like the prosecutions we've seen under universal jurisdiction in Germany recently for crimes committed during the war in Syria. But there is no reason to give up hope on this prospect. And really what is required of the international community of leaders of states is a commitment to end impunity. And that means supporting the tribunals. It means supporting the International Criminal Court. It means giving the resources available to document and then to subsequently prosecute. And, you know, it is the responsibility of states. They have a responsibility, treaty obligations under the Geneva Conventions, to prosecute war crimes, to seek out and to prosecute individuals responsible for those war crimes. So, you know, a lot of this is about meeting existing obligations and abiding by their legal responsibilities. Human Rights Watch is more focused on is less focused on the crime of aggression, but of course the impunity that reigns for these other crimes. You know, if there was more prosecution, if there was more impetus to address these, we certainly believe there would be fewer crimes.
Yeah, we just have 2 minutes left, unfortunately, Professor Sands. Is the fundamental architecture of international law and how it seeks justice in the wake of war weakened for as long as the United States, per Jack's point earlier, and as you said as well, stands by quietly?
I mean, I want the United States on board. I have spent a lot of time looking at Nuremberg. The extraordinary role played by the United States, the extraordinary role played by individuals like Robert Jackson. I want the US leading from the front. And the events of the last 20 years have precluded that from happening. I wonder whether this is the moment for them to up their game. I just want to follow on what's just been said. I mean, there is no greater supporter than I of the work of Human Rights Watch, and I totally support the focus on war crimes and crimes against humanity. But it distresses me greatly that Human Rights Watch is not focusing on the crime of aggression, the top people who are responsible for these horrors. Amnesty International, for the first time in its history, has come out and said, this is a crime of aggression. And I invite Human Rights Watch now to start focusing on this in addition to the other areas. We need bodies like Human Rights Watch and the United States focusing on the main individuals who are responsible for the greatest horrors.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we have to wrap up. Professor Philippe Sands, Director of the Center on International Courts and Tribunals at University College London and author of East West Street, thank you so much for joining us. And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you as well.
Thank you, Magda.
And Richard Weir with the Crisis and Conflict Division at Human Rights Watch, joining us today from Lviv in Ukraine. Richard, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.